A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
On the 20th of November, 1815, with the signing of the Treaty of Paris, the Napoleonic Wars passed into memory. Yet for those who had fought and suffered, the pain in many cases went on. The struggle for recognition amongst those who had given so much to the wars against Napoleonic France would take decades. Whilst the Waterloo veterans were swiftly recognised, many of those who had fought in other theatres would die before they were considered worthy of a medal. For many of these men, their headstones were the only surviving testament to their service, a few lines carved in stone proudly attesting to what they had done for their country. For the poor, they didn't even get that. Placed in communal graves, an unassuming patch of earth whose significance has long been forgotten is all that remains. It is for this reason that, time and again, in my capacity as chair and founder of the Napoleonic and Revolutionary War Graves Charity, I've said that the NRWGC is arriving on the scene 200 years too late. We have lost contact with these veterans, have forgotten their stories, and the locations of their graves have disappeared into the mists of time. When they are found, the forces of nature have often wrought their worst, leaving memorials crumbling and covered in grime. How do we go about trying to undo the damage of two centuries of neglect? What does it take to start from scratch with no knowledge of who is buried where and to reach an endpoint where a Napoleonic veteran's resting place is not only rediscovered, but also enjoys the quiet dignity that we offer any veteran who has served in more recent times? For the last 3 months, the NRWGC has been working on a unique project with the University of Portsmouth, which has seen four history undergraduates embark on an ambitious project to research, locate, document, and restore the graves in the maritime city of Portsmouth. It was a quest that would take them to archives and graveyards across Hampshire and even a naval base in the pursuit of knowledge. Tonight, the stars of that project, Portsmouth Uni undergrads Izzy Turtle, Emily Harris, Rebecca Money and Damiana Kuhn, join me to tell all about the biggest outreach project the NRWGC has embarked on to date. They talk about the difficulties of accessing reliable information about the graves of veterans, the toils and tribulations of negotiating with local authorities on grave cleaning, what you can and can't do when it comes to these graves, and why they felt compelled to request access to a naval base when an aircraft carrier was in port. This is Tomb Finders, Hunters of Our Napoleonic Past. Up next on the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Hello and welcome back to the Napoleonic Wars Pod, where for only the second time ever, I am the oldest person on the episode, and I'm not entirely sure I like it. My crown as the baby-faced Napoleon nerd is at risk of falling off my admittedly rapidly receding hairline. However, my discomfort is all for a good cause, because today we are showcasing a story that is quite frankly more than a little inspiring. Four students from the University of Portsmouth have been working in association with the Napoleonic and Revolutionary War Graves Charity to uncover forgotten graves and monuments across the city, which, as we're going to hear, was not only remarkably successful, but was also hugely ambitious and certainly far exceeded anything I'd anticipated when I first negotiated the project with the team at Portsmouth Uni. I am therefore joined by Damiana Kuhn, Rebecca Money, Emily Harris, and Izzy Turtle, the four students who have been working for the last 3 months on this project. Welcome, all of you. Let's start by focusing on the project itself. As part of your second year at Portsmouth, you were given a choice of projects that you could work on, which basically meant we had to bid for your interest. What was it that drew you towards the NRWGC as something you might want to work on?
I mean, for me personally, I've seen a lot of grave cleaning on social media, and I saw it in the description. It just kind of piqued my interest a bit. Because I think I was the one that originally was like, oh, maybe this could be an option. I just kind of thought it was quite a noble pursuit.
We originally got given a choice of, I think, 19 or 20 different projects that we could pick from. And we sort of got together as a group and chose our favourite three and then compromised based on what we'd all chosen. And we all felt like it was a really interesting opportunity to do something more practical when obviously a lot of a history course is lots and lots of writing. So it felt like a really unique thing to be able to do.
Thanks for that, Izzy. Anyone else want to chime in on that? Okay, that's knows that I'm getting around the room. This is actually the first time we've ever recorded one of these in a room. So the logistics of doing this are making my brain melt slightly. I guess the follow-up question to that is, did it turn out to be what you expected? Because it's one thing for me to write a little blurb going, yeah, how about you kind of come and clean a grave for us? But I'm also acutely aware that I'm pitching such a project to a bunch of people in their early 20s. And the idea of basically, look, would you like to come and be free manual labour for us, isn't necessarily something that appeals to most people. So did it actually end up matching up with what you'd anticipated? Rebecca, do you want to start us off?
I think because kind of the project started quite suddenly, everything was pretty rapid in getting into what we needed to do. I think it might be how we expected, maybe a little bit more. I don't think anyone's really anticipated actually cleaning a grave or going on a Navy base. Yeah, I think it was a lot more interesting than we probably could have anticipated.
The process of the grave cleaning was also very memorable because it's not every day that you brag about getting to clean an Napoleonic War grave. So that was very interesting and fascinating.
Yeah, I must admit, the grave fought us. They always do. The graves fight back. And people will be listening to that going, what the hell are you on about, Zach? I haven't been smoking anything, listeners, but they do. And we picked this grave in part because of the history. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But also because I took one look at it and went, well, this is marble. Marble ends up cleaning up and looking lovely and shiny and white. That'll be nice and easy for us. And my experience is that actually marble is the biggest pain in the backside of all of the stones to clean because it just does not cooperate. But before we get into that, let's rewind to the beginning. So you all arrived at my office. I know I have an office now, people. It's almost like I'm important. So you all arrived at my office on a chilly February morning. And I basically had to break the news to you that we didn't have a clue about anybody who may or may not have been buried here in Portsmouth. And that you were literally going to be the first people to attempt this on behalf of the charity. And the point of this episode fundamentally is to talk about that process that you went through, because I was staggered at the degree of success that you had, and even more so considering how ambitious you were. Because had you presented me with, you know, the option of, hey, why don't we go on a naval base and go and find this guy? I'd have been like, no, that's we're not even going to bother trying with that. But because you guys turned around and said, we're doing this, Zach, I kind of had to go and do some admin to make it happen. So I just want to talk through that whole process, frankly. And we'll start with how you went about trying to track down who was buried in the city. And we'll break this down because I'm hoping that your story is going to inspire listeners to get involved and potentially volunteer with the NRWGC and literally follow in your footsteps. So we'll start with the where, first of all. How did you work out where these people were, how did you find out the potential contender sites for burial? Emily?
So I think Google was our best friend to begin with. Definitely that's where, that was the starting point. And then we had a Google Doc where we all kind of would sit together, go on, find a grave. That was very useful. And we'd put in any contenders, and it was kind of narrowing the search down. So kind of people born from about 1790 and then died before 1870. Yeah, so it was just kind of, yeah, online at first, for sure.
Is it?
Yeah, we sort of narrowed down the cemeteries and churchyards that we wanted to look at based on when they started being used for, you know, sort of who was buried in them within the scope of the time span of your scope of interest, I suppose, Napoleonic veterans. And then Rebecca, being the very organised person that she is, began to create a colour code chart for everyone we found, and we colour coded each cemetery and made a big, yeah, a big Google Doc that we all had access to, and we just kept adding and adding and adding. And Rebecca thankfully kept us well organised while we just added lots of stuff. So that was the first steps, I think.
And once we did that, we saw that the two contestants for the cemetery visit and the grave cleaning was Kingston Cemetery and Highland Road Cemetery, because they had the largest number of names on the Google Doc.
Going back to kind of discussing what we did on Find a Grave, I found the best way to approach the situation was after we'd found our cemeteries and which were best for that. You look at the birth dates or the death dates of these people and kind of figure out, would they have been a part of the wars? And sometimes it was difficult because you'd see the names and you go, oh, they could be, but there was no information about them at all. But other times it was quite easy because you'd see their military ranks, and that was quite an easy way to figure out if they were potentially viable or not.
Yeah, as we said at the top of the show, this is a real problem, right? That we don't know where people are, first of all. And I must admit, partly because it was kind of in the remit, I wasn't allowed to be exceptionally helpful, because the idea of this project was that you guys went and did the legwork. But we also didn't have the information. So it was like, look, lots of luck, you know. And you're dead right, Emily. I mean, my suggestion to you was start with Google, find out where people are buried, first of all, in the city, because I don't know. I've only been here a few months. And then from that, there was a lot of logic to how you approached it. As Damiana says, you know, trying to work out where are the biggest concentrations, there was a lot of logic to that. And I think for our listeners who are potentially interested in doing this, sometimes the simplest thing is to just pick the biggest, most obvious locations. So the churches in your town or village, the cemeteries that are nearby, and just walk into them. And don't get me wrong, folks, you are not going to be tripping over these people, as we're going to hear in due course. There's a much more kind of carefully considered, more historical, I guess, research process that can help you to speed up that process. But sometimes just walking into a cemetery, or particularly if you're walking into a church, looking at memorials up on walls, sometimes just doing that and just snapping them can be really helpful. And as Izzy says, that process of whittling people down can actually be quite useful, in the sense that for the charity, we focus on people who served between 1775 and 1815, which therefore means that you can start to work out ish when people would have been born, ish when they would have died, because most of these veterans are dead or dying into the sort of 1850s, 60s and 70s. The last veteran from the British side, well, the last British officer rather to die at Waterloo dies in, I believe, 1891. He's in Southampton Cemetery. So, you know, by the second half of the 19th century, most of these guys are gone or are going. And that does help in terms of narrowing things down. You know, you don't need to peer at the ones that very obviously say died in 1910. So let's move on to the archive search, because that was where the historical skills really came into play. And that wasn't easy in itself, partly because burial registers don't really exist in many cases. And so you would think, well, this is dead easy. You know, you just open up a burial register, job done. It wasn't quite that simple, though. But we did find a solution to the challenge of trying to access records on who was buried where. Talk us through this neat little kind of solution, because I can confidently say that I would love to just send people in archives to replicate what you guys did. So there's a hint, listeners, if you've got the time, pay attention to what's about to follow. And if you can, please replicate this for us, because we need help.
Emily, start us off.
Okay, so we basically tackled some of the memorial lists, which were made after the Second World War, kind of. And obviously we're looking at them 50 years on, so that is the issue of, you know, these graves are going to be in a different state to what they were in when these were recorded. But we ended up splitting the bigger one. So me and Damiana took on Kingston Cemetery, and then Rebecca and Izzy took on Highland Cemetery. And I think that definitely made it a lot easier, rather than, you know, just chaos. It was very organized.
And just give our listeners an indication, how are these different from the burial registers? What's the distinction there?
So the difference between the burial records and the memorial list that we were looking at is that a burial record lists everyone that was buried in the area, but whether or not they have a tombstone or anything to signify who they were is a sort of a different story. The memorial records were drawn up after the Second World War just to register everything that was surviving after the bombs sort of took out quite a lot of memorials and gravestones in the Portsmouth area. We found quite a few of those in Highland Road Cemetery when we went and looked. We also, while we were in the archive, we looked at a couple of other options, including the Royal Garrison Churchyard. We looked at St Anne's. And when we were looking at St Anne's, we found that there was a memorial for Frederick Lewis Maitland, who was the captain of the Bellerophon when Napoleon was captured. So we found that it was on the Portsmouth Naval Base in St Anne's Chapel. At that point, we weren't exactly sure how we were going to get there. We didn't really know that it was in the restricted sort of high security area at that time. So we were a little bit ambitious with saying we wanted to see it. And Zach really helped us get that moving.
I mean, yeah, you turned around to me
and basically said, yeah, so we, I mean, I basically pointed it. So I was meant to be helpful, folks. But you know me by now, I'm not a particularly helpful individual at the best of times. So I basically was told that, you know, health and safety, and I'm meant to be the historian with knowledge about historying. And so, you know, go along and help at the archives and generally make myself useful, which I think it's fair to say I didn't do, because I basically pointed to this big box of these lists, because they are just literally on the shelves in the archive reading room, so you don't even need to order them up beforehand, and said, look, have a go and have a look at those and make the best of it. And at the end of it, you kind of turned around to me and said, so yeah, we found this guy called Maitland, at which point my eyes, as you can imagine, folks, shot open, because the Maitland family are just steeped in the whole 1815 story. And so we had a little look at the details, and it very quickly became apparent that it was the Maitland who arrested Napoleon on Bellerophon. But he was on Portsmouth Naval Base. Initially, we didn't realise this until we Googled the church. And then I've got four undergrads saying, well, yeah, we can just go and have a look at that, can't we? At which point I went, security might be an issue. You literally want to get on one of the most secure locations in the UK. And it got worse, because by the time we'd done the admin, there was a aircraft carrier in port, so it wasn't even just standard naval base security. Let's stay with the Maitland memorial, though. Why were you so adamant on Maitland? Because I must admit, my brain went through a series of options in the sort of half second after you said it. And one of those was, maybe we just shouldn't do Maitland, because how the hell am I going to get permission to bring 420-year-olds onto a naval base? I just don't see that happening. So what you guys can't see because of the radio show element is that some of them have just flicked their hair in that kind of L'Oreal because I'm worth it style, which is a meme that I enjoy intensely using on many occasions. So I just thought I'd share that one with you. But why were you so adamant about Maitland? What was the deal with him?
I think more than anything else, it felt like a challenge. And when we saw Zach's reaction, it only made us want to do it more. And it did stick out to us as we Googled it, and we found out that it was completely inaccessible without security clearance. And as such an important figure, and as someone with a local history as well, he was Admiral Superintendent of Portsmouth Dockyard for, I think, 5 years. So he doesn't have a memorial in Portsmouth that's accessible to the public whatsoever, I believe. And we saw a couple of pictures of it as well, and it looked like something quite grand and something that we felt like we should bring more attention to. So that's why we wanted to go with that.
And there's also a point about where Maitland is buried, right? Talk us through that, Emily.
He died off the coast of Bombay, so he isn't physically buried in England. There isn't an actual grave you can go to visit.
Yeah, from the charity's perspective, this was a real kind of head scratcher, because sure, Maitland's grave is somewhere out in India. We actually haven't gone and had a look for him, unsurprisingly. The charity isn't prepared to just flash the cash and give me an all expenses paid trip to India. More's the pity. I know, shocking. But this was part of the reason that I was inclined to relent, not just the sort of the piercing stare of these four undergraduates saying, look, this is your job, go make it happen. But also the fact that it's, as Izzy's just said, it's kind of hidden away from the public, not in a kind of nefarious, oh, we don't want you to see this kind of way, but just its physical location. It's not easy to get onto the naval base for very obvious and very valid reasons. So to bring this to the public attention was really important. Let's talk about some of the others that you found and what you discovered in terms of their histories, either at the church itself, or maybe want to leave the church for a little bit later, but also just within Portsmouth more generally. I must say you found a lot of people. It was quite impressive. I mean, you should have found a lot of people, in fairness, because nobody had looked at this before. But talk us through, you know, some of the key people that you found and their histories. Who wants to start us off? Damiana?
So one of the individuals we found was George Gawler. So he was born in 1795 and died in 1869. He served in the 52nd Light Infantry, fought in the Peninsular War in 1812, which was Spain, Portugal and UK fighting against France. And he was also part in the advance of Madrid and Spain. But once his regiment returned to England, Gawler, as a lieutenant, then fought in the Battle of Waterloo, which was very fascinating.
I think an important thing to add on that is that he led the 52nd Right Company at charges at Waterloo against the Imperial Guard, which is clearly quite a significant thing compared to just being a normal foot soldier that was in part of that. His career kind of continued a bit after that, but he was given sick leave after issues with his sight. He went to Ireland a little bit after that, and eventually went on to being in South Australia, where he was, I think, second governor. He did quite a bit of surveying in the area and got decent results with that, and dealt with some crises revolving around crop failures in 1840. When he finally returned to England, I think he struggled with a couple of differences between, obviously, the culture between England and Australia. He also had, I think there were some issues with him and other people in public, such as, I think it was whatever Earl Grey's first name was, but, you know. And he continued to have an interest in South Australia, and he also had an interesting interest in the resettlement of Jews into Palestine, which is kind of relevant today. But he eventually spent his final years in South Sea and passed on the 7th of May of pneumonia.
I mean, talk about a significant guy at a pivotal moment in history, leading one of the flank companies of the 52nd as it sweeps out of the line without orders, it should be said. It's just Adams taking the initiative. I'm hoping that listeners are aware of what happens at Waterloo. Otherwise, this makes no sense whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, a guy who is integral to sweeping away that third assault by the Imperial Guard in the closing stages of Waterloo, and then continuing to steady his men as they march across the face of the Allied army all the way to the centre of the battlefield, and then continuing to push south. This is a guy who's right at the heart of it. And then just, you know, casually has an argument with Earl Grey, as you do. We've all been there, surely. But his grave is, there are complicated stories regarding his grave, aren't there? Izzy, do you want to say a little bit about this?
Yeah, so in the course of our research, Gawler was a name that just kept coming up and coming up really, really often. And when we sort of were looking at his Find a Grave website, we noticed that his headstone just looked a bit too nice for the time. So we sort of did some more research into that, and we found that his headstone had been replaced by a different organisation in, I think, 2002. And that the placement of this new headstone was actually not where Gawler was buried at all. So despite the fact that he is somewhere in Highland Road Cemetery in Portsmouth, the tombstone is not sort of where he's buried. We don't know where he's buried. And it was quite shiny anyway, so we didn't feel like it was necessarily the best candidate for cleaning in comparison to some of the others. But yeah, Gawler's grave gave us a little bit of an issue there.
Yeah, there's a really nice point there about when to intervene and when not to intervene, which we're going to discuss further in a bit. But, you know, it wasn't just Gawler and Maitland that you went after. Who else did you discover? Because you had a list that you presented to me and then said, we're going to go and find these. And I was like, are you going to find them? Because I was skeptical. And once again, you proved me wrong, which was impressive. Who else did we go in the hunt for?
One of the first people that we found when we went to visit the cemetery was General William Hallett Connolly. And he fought in quite a few battles, so he's quite an important figure. And he died in 1861 in South Sea at 80 years old, and he's buried with his wife and daughters.
In addition to this, we also found Major General Thomas Purdwire, who is the one we actually cleaned the grave of. So he was born in Ireland in 1798 and died in South Sea in 1863. There wasn't loads that we could find about him, but he was based at Chatham HQ quite a bit throughout his time. And during the Napoleonic Wars, he was on HMS Forth and HMS Dublin. He later went to the Americas, and I believe it was said that he got yellow fever over there, and then came back and was stationed quite a bit at Portsmouth. On his grave, he was buried with his wife, his son, and interestingly, his grandson was on there, who died at the age of 16, and I think it was to scarlet fever.
Dwyer was quite an interesting find because he'd already had some quite intense research done on him for a person's family history. So we were able to find quite a lot about him online. And he'd kept a diary through the course of his career, which also gave us some nice sort of unique insight because quite a few of the others on our list didn't have anything that we could find about them at all. So yeah, it was really nice to be able to sort of hear from Dwyer in his own words. We also found another couple of people at Highland Road. So when we were in the archives, we also researched Kingston, but didn't end up finding as much as we wanted. So when we went to Highland, I think we had a list of five or six names. And we also found Pryor. And Rebecca, tell us a bit.
So there's not too much that we know about Thomas Murray Prior, apart from that on his gravestone, it said that he was involved in both Peninsula and Waterloo. He was part of the cavalry regiment, the 18th Hussars. And other than that, that's all we kind of know. There was quite a bit of information about his son with the same name if you research it. But other than that, there's not too much about him himself.
I think that gives us a really nice insight into some of the breadth of individuals that you're able to find. Obviously, all of these guys were officers, which is quite often the way. And I know that was one of the things that disappointed you, that we weren't able to uncover any of the rank and file. But folks, that's the reality of what you're dealing with. And the source material that remains, you know, if you're going and using memorial lists, then you need to be aware of the fact that the people with the most substantial memorials were invariably the officers, because they could afford the stone that has then endured in order for us to be able to go and find these people. And it wasn't plain sailing for you, which is something that I really do want to emphasize. You know, it was almost sort of sounding as though this project had sort of was treated sort of the Dick Whittington effect of, you know, streets paved with gold and you just kind of waltzed in and waltzed out and it was all very easy. And it really, really wasn't, because the local authorities, if nothing else, had their, should we say, reservations. Give us a sense of some of the challenges that you faced and how you worked with the NRWGC to navigate them. Emily?
So initially we emailed asking for permission to potentially clean Dwyer's grave. And they basically said that, they basically said no, not a chance.
And why was that?
I think mostly because we're not insured individually. I think that was their main worry.
In the email, they also said that they don't know who owns the grave, so they had to get permission from the owners, which would be a lot of tedious work. And also they mentioned that because most of the graves are covered in ivy, it comes with safety and risk, and health risk. So the council essentially told us, no, we can't work on any graves.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, this was one of the real challenges with this one that, and we've kind of touched on this already in relation to the naval base, right? We're talking here about 4 20-year-olds trying to go to people in positions of authority and responsibility and saying, look, folks, we want to come and clean a grave, or we want to just kind of waltz onto a naval base, and that's okay, right? And inevitably, a lot of people kind of turn around and go, no, there's like legal stuff, because what if you injure yourself? Are you going to sue me? Which is a real problem. And this was part of where the charity came in, right? How did the charity kind of assist in resolving some of those challenges? Izzy?
Yeah, although we had name dropped Zach and the charity in our original email, it didn't seem to go as far as when Zach himself emailed them and gave them a bit more information, and quite a lot of their concerns seemed to quite conveniently drop out of relevance. So it ended up being that we just needed someone with a bit more cred to back us when we were trying to get in and to clean the graves.
I am shocked and appalled that the mere mention of my name is not sufficient to make local councils bow to everybody's will.
what is this madness? But yeah, no, the serious point here is that if you're just a lone wolf with the best of intentions, kind of wanting to rock up to these places and go, look, I'm going to do a thing, then people are going to turn around and go, well, have you really considered the implications? How do I know that I can trust you to use, for example, the right cleaning methods? You know, are you insured? So that if you get injured, you don't come after the local council for having tripped over a lump of masonry. And as we're probably going to discuss in a second, you know, some of these graves are not in great condition. So if a grave falls on you, which hasn't happened to me yet, but, you know, never say never, you need these councils and other authorities need to know that you've been trained with how to deal with the inverted commas dangers. You know, you're not Indiana Jones going and doing all of this, but nonetheless, there are dangers associated with it. And I think that's why when we sat down with the team at Portsmouth Uni, this was a project that was able to be brought together because the charity has the necessary covers and the legal frameworks and responsibilities to sort some of these problems. And also we have more experience with things like grave ownership, where we can have those conversations and talk about things like leases expiring and all the rest of it, which is ultimately why we were able to go ahead with the cleaning. But before we get to the cleaning, let's talk about site visit day. And as Izzy said already, Rebecca, you'd done some serious prep. The organisation, I mean, I've done a lot of site visits in my time. I have never colour-coded or sketched my own map of a grave site in advance. And what I'm doing there is stealing all of your thunder and talking about all of the preparation that you've done, which is very bad podcasting. But talk us through what you actually had to do when it came to physically assessing these graves.
So I want to start by pointing about the fact that yes, I might be organised, but I do it so that we're not all stressed when we're going around a graveyard, going, I don't know where anyone is. I haven't looked at the photos and gone on Google Maps and found that one of them's actually visible from the road. But yeah, I colour-coded a map, made sure that I used all the references we found from the archive to try and make it easy to go around the cemetery rather than going and spending maybe 10 hours or so trying to find these graves by just reading everything. But when we went round, it was a case of look at the graves and see what kind of stone they were, how bad a state they were. And obviously we mentioned Gawler's, his was quite fine. It wasn't the worst. Pryor's was also pretty clean, but there were ones like, we haven't mentioned this guy, but his name was Samuel Perkins Pritchard. I think he was some form of admiral or vice admiral or something, but his grave was in such a bad condition. It was peeling. And I think we discussed, and there's not really anything the charity could really do about this. But some of the graves were not the best state, and Connolly's grave had been attempted to be cleaned to the point where I think it was with the wrong solution or something, and the stone wasn't looking very good.
Yeah, so there are some really interesting points that you raised there. One is preparation is absolutely key to this. And the more information you can use, you can acquire beforehand, the better. And, you know, we're going to talk about top tips in a second. That is the ultimate top tip, is do your research beforehand, because you can spend hours macheting your way through brambles. And I say that from experience. And getting nowhere fast. And I've lost hours of my life to just kind of turning up and peering at headstones and kind of going, are you what I'm looking for? No, you're not what I'm looking for. Are you what I'm looking for? No, you're not what I'm looking for. And repeating that for like a few hundred graves in a particular over churchyard, so that there's absolutely no need to justify it, because it was the absolute model of how to do this. And I didn't realize you'd gone and looked on Google Maps and Street View beforehand. That was smart. Kudos there. And then, you know, you mentioned Connolly. Yes, Connolly was a bizarre one, because somebody had very clearly tried to clean the grave, but you have to be very careful with what you use to clean graves. And we'll discuss this in just a second when we talk about cleaning. But it struck me that somebody had probably used something like a metal brush to try and scrub the inscription for Connolly, because it was just far too eroded around the lettering on his grave. And either somebody had put the wrong solution on there, and we'll talk about that, but or somebody had just used the wrong materials to carry out that cleaning. So some really important themes there. Have you got any more top tips that you would give anyone kind of going and doing a grave visit and sort of assessing these graves? Izzy?
I think definitely get your own Rebecca and someone who can do a bit of FBI work. I mean, she was looking at satellite imagery of the and tracking down the exact shapes of each grave. And it was just really, really helped us cut down on our time that we spent in the cemetery. And also, I think try and just look at as many pictures as you can to get a sense of scale. I mean, I think when I went on the visit, I had a bit of favouritism and sort of wanted to clean Connolly's grave before I'd actually seen it. But as Zach said, it was in really bad condition and it had attempted to be cleaned before, but it was also really, really tall and none of us are, except Emily. And so we would have needed, you know, a stepladder, multiple stepladders, and also it was sort of falling apart from the top down, so possibly hard hats. So I think just really try and get a sense of the scale of the grave you're looking at as well, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, stepladders did feature in this story, as we'll discover when we talk about the naval base. But yeah, there was a really important point about realism. And the key thing is do your prep beforehand. Now, inevitably, not every grave has a photo attached to it. But if you can, at the very least, you know, start by picking out those graves that do have photos and use that as the basis, then if nothing else, you can, you know, get some momentum behind you. And I think that was probably one of the more enjoyable site visits that I've ever been on, in that we had a list of however many, I think it was about six, and we found all of them within the space of a couple of hours. And that is easily the most successful site visit that I've done in a long time. Again, you can't see this because it's a radio show, but everybody's kind of quietly applauding Rebecca, and rightly so. We've talked already about that decision on what who you would and wouldn't clean, you know, sort of feasibility. I didn't know that Izzy had an agenda and wanted Connolly cleaned, but hey, there we go. Let's talk about the cleaning itself. No, actually, before we talk about the cleaning itself, let's talk about you talking your way onto a naval base in an entirely legal and proper manner through the appropriate channels. There was nothing clandestine. I mean, admittedly, I'm not sure you can be clandestine in trying to sort of bring a 30-year-old lecturer and four 20-year-olds onto a naval base. You know, there are like gates and security guards and things. The point behind this was, I mean, Izzy, you kept talking about something called photogrammetry. Well, you have explained this to me multiple times and I still don't really understand what it is. Explain it to our listeners.
So essentially, the situation that the Maitland Memorial was in with not being publicly accessible, I thought it might be nice to try and do something that meant that a lot more people could see it in its sort of full glory. I mean, obviously, a photo can only do so much. It's completely one-dimensional. So I sort of really wanted to do some photogrammetry, which is essentially taking hundreds of photos painstakingly from every angle possible, or at least every angle available to me at 5'4" on a wobbly stepladder. So we then put that through a program that sort of compiles all the photos and it triangulates where exactly each point of the photo is. And it can then sort of do some guesswork and make a 3D model from your 3D or 360 angle photos of the memorial. I'm hopeful that it will turn out okay. It's still in progress just because of time and computer memory limitations. But yeah, I'm hopeful that it will turn out okay. Although I am worried about the top of Maitland's head, as I am only 5'4". But yeah, look out for that, I suppose.
That's not a phrase that you hear on every podcast. I am worried about the top of Maitland's head. I mean, I was actually worried that you were going to fall off that stepladder. I mean, we talk about sacrifices made for this charity, like serious injury due to stepladder collapse on a naval base. That would have taken some explaining to an insurer. That's for sure. But in the process of this, you found some other interesting individuals, didn't you? Talk us through that.
No. So while Izzy was very admirably risking her life on the ladder, we were having a little look and we found a memorial for the Austin brothers. Daddy Austin, as Zach put nicely earlier, was actually admirable. I can't talk. Admiral, sorry.
You're still recovering from me describing him as Daddy Austin.
So that's, I think that's quite interesting. I mean, especially if you're an English lit nerd like myself, that did excite me quite a bit. Sir William Cornwallis, who was commander in chief on the Channel Fleet, which, you know, helped stop the Napoleonic invasion, very, very significant figure. So it was very cool to see him buried there. He died in 1890.
So we're still laughing about the fact that one of my students has dropped me in it. I mean, look, by this point, listeners, you are used to the fact that I'm not one who uses technical terms at the best of times. But yeah, we had discussed the Austin brothers and why they're remembered, because actually they're army rather than navy peeps. And as I put it, yes, I referred to him as, well, Daddy Austin was an admiral. Admiral, you got me not being able to say admiral either. Now it's catching. So I've never been dropped in it on this podcast. So there's a first time for everything. Obviously, we can't talk about Portsmouth without saying a huge thank you to Ralph and Tom from the chaplaincy team on Portsmouth Naval Base. Obviously, we won't mention surnames for security reasons. And also to Kate Jameson from the 1805 Club for helping to facilitate with contacts. And actually, that memorial to Cornwallis was installed by the 1805 Club. So it's been great to see the work of other organisations in terms of lots of people trying to do something about this problem, but inevitably being stuck with this problem of finite budgets and all the rest of it. Back to your story, though, and it's fair to say that you didn't stop there, because having braved the perils of stepladders and security guards at naval bases and the risk of, I don't know, being scratched by a particularly aggressive bramble in Highland Road Cemetery on a site visit, you then quite literally, and kudos here because you put an absolute shift in, you literally got your hands dirty with grave cleaning. Talk folks through what you used to clean Dwyer's grave, and I guess why the charity uses that technique specifically, because we are very particular at the NRWGC about how we go about this stuff. Emily?
I think one of the most important things I learned was do not use bleach. Avoid bleach at all costs. We used D2 solution and doused the grave in that, left it to kind of sit for 10 minutes, do its stuff. Oh, and we scraped, you know, stuff off first. Izzy very admirably got rid of all the snails and living creatures. So no one was hurt. Well, no bugs were harmed, except for maybe one spider.
Can I just say, I have never been on a grave clean, whereas there has been so much attention paid to the perils of worms. Like, this was a whole new experience. But Izzy, I guess you want to talk more about the environmental impetus behind your efforts.
Just to clarify, when Emily says got rid, I did relocate them very gently nearby so that they can still be with Dwyer, albeit not on his grave. But yeah, the D2, I think, is biodegradable and non-toxic, so we did our best to make sure that no sort of living creatures were harmed in the process. But overall, it's quite a gentle solution and something that shouldn't have any like environmental impact on the area surrounding the grave, because we did use quite a lot of it.
Yeah, after we left it for 10 minutes, we got some brushes, not metal brushes, don't use metal brushes. And we started scrubbing, and it was also really important to use water to get the dirt off, and you could see the results more clearly.
Can I just say that when we were like using the brushes, I kind of felt like a paleontologist while cleaning the Napoleonic War grave. My childhood son would be very jealous.
I mean, you make it sound incredibly glamorous, but it couldn't be less glamorous. The nature of this. So the reason that most stone has discoloration is quite simply it's got algae in it. So the way this solution works is that it does kill the algae within the pores of the stone. But as Izzy says, it's completely safe for wider environmental purposes. And then by killing the algae, it's no longer rooted in the pores. It comes to the surface. We did discuss, as Emily alluded to, the fact that some folks, perhaps with the best of intentions, use bleach. Do you want to talk people through why that's a deeply problematic process, particularly in relation to marble?
Yeah, so the reason that bleach isn't used when cleaning the graves is because it goes into like the stone, and then obviously when it dries, it kind of expands and creates these crystals, and it generally just damages the stone. And we saw that when looking at Connolly's grave and how the stone had been damaged from someone trying to clean it. And obviously there's no going back from that apart from getting a new stone.
Absolutely. And it is a slower process. It does mean that you're looking at, you guys had this, right? So I mentioned how the stone kind of fights back, and marble is a pig for this. Again, technical terminology there, of course. By the end of probably about 3 hours working on this grave, it looked better, but it didn't look white by any stretch of the imagination. But the solution will continue to work. The rainwater will wash away the stuff that rises to the surface. And so later this month, there'll be a revisit where we'll take another look at how things have gone with it. And there should be a noticeable improvement, but it does take weeks and months. And I think that's perhaps why some people are inclined to resort to faster acting solutions that can be bleach based or soap based. So sodium hypochlorite, for example, is a very, very dilute form of bleach. And it's a patio cleaner, which kind of says it all. You know, you shouldn't be using something that's designed for cleaning patios on a very precious and delicate monument. So it was interesting to see your reactions to the cleaning process. But I think it's fair to say that you appreciated the fact that conservation is the key emphasis here, and preserving heritage is fundamental. I guess that kind of leads us towards the end. But what would you say to anyone thinking about getting involved with something like this? And what tips do you have to people in terms of the do's, but also the don'ts? Damiana?
So the do's is wear comfy clothes when cleaning the grave, because it is a tedious job. But I think another to do is to enjoy the experience, even if in thought and in practice. It is a tedious work, but what work isn't? And the result is very rewarding at the end. It feels like you've done some justice to the memory of the individual that you're cleaning, especially because it's a veteran during a time in history, which is often forgotten to be commemorated.
I think also, if you are planning to volunteer, don't be afraid to ask for help when you need it, in terms of getting the access you need, or just any sort of help that you might need at all, any advice or any questions. I think Zach has been very enthusiastic help for us. And I think what could have been quite a morbid topic was actually quite touching in the end. And even fun at times. I think it was very much a team effort, and I think we all really enjoyed working together and got to know each other a lot more over the process. And I think just have fun with it.
One of the things I'd say is, well, we did this project as part of a module, so this has happened over the course of 3-4 months. When it comes to people volunteering, take your time. You don't have to rush and do it around working. You know, you can do it over a while, and as long as you stay organized and keep everything together, potentially in one document of all where you have all the names, where they're buried, as they organize, kind of like what I did the whole way through, it shouldn't take too much effort, and you should be able to get some results, but it's obviously not guaranteed, but something is better than nothing.
I think honestly, just get stuck in, because there was definitely elements that I wasn't particularly looking forward to, but then I actually found I really enjoyed. It's definitely a bonding experience. So I think bring a friend, that makes it way more fun. And wear clothes you don't care about getting muddy, because as my housemate said when I got back in, woof, you look like you've been dragged through the trenches.
I think also just to go on what Emily said about that there were aspects that she wasn't necessarily that excited about. I think you don't have to do everything. We did because it was our module and it's what we had chosen to do. But if you're volunteering your time, you can just do things like an archive visit or some research from home or a site visit. Or if you really, really want to do it, you can really do some grave cleaning. And I think I was really not looking forward to that at the beginning, but I found it so satisfying and quite cathartic in the end to be able to see sort of the culmination of quite a few months of work coming together. But yeah, I think don't feel like you have to do everything or take on every single aspect.
That is exceptionally well said. The success of what the four of you've achieved on this project has honestly blown my mind. I thought in all probability you'd find maybe four graves, do some site reports for us, and then do a write-up. But it's been genuinely incredible to watch your successes. And it's a remarkable reminder to me, mired as I often am in all of the admin of running the charity, what this is all about and why this exceptionally ambitious project in the form of the NRWGC is so worthwhile. The cynic in me would have been massively hesitant to go and find Maitland, primarily because of the challenges of trying to get on the base. So it has been ridiculously refreshing, quite frankly, to work with you all. Once again, a massive thank you to Ralph and Tom from the chaplaincy at Portsmouth Naval Base, Kate Jameson for helping with the contacts, the team at Portsmouth City Council for their time, and the staff here at Portsmouth University for negotiating this project with the NRWGC. But most importantly, an absolutely massive thank you to Izzy, Emily, Damiana and Rebecca for joining me to discuss all of this and for your enthusiasm and dedication over the course of the project. It has been brilliant working with you. And folks, if you've been inspired by Rebecca, Damiana, Izzy and Emily's story, you can head over to the Napoleonic and Revolutionary War Graves Charity website to find out more. Visit www.nrwgc.com/donate if you'd like to help to contribute to the huge costs of grave cleaning, restoration and maintenance, or consider whether you'd be interested in becoming a member. You get a whole range of bonus perks too, including huge discounts at the events that we run over the course of the year. However, if you're willing to give us that most precious of commodities, your time, we'd love to hear from you. Just head to www.nrwgc.com to find out more about how you can follow in the footsteps of these students in projects across the UK and around the world and kickstart your own inspiring story in Napoleonic history.
I'll be back very soon, but until then, I'm Zach White. This has been the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Take care of yourselves, my friends. Stay well, stay safe. And as always, thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.